I will be spending, I guess, 3 weeks with you in September discussing relativity. But the first thing I want to say is a huge welcome to all of you. You've done incredibly well to be accepted to Perimeter. As you will discover, this is, if you haven't discovered already, this is a very, very unusual and very special place. And I want to tell you a little story, which I hope would sort of put Perimeter in the right perspective in your minds. So imagine that at some point, somebody discovered the secret to progress. Okay, and suddenly, in a flash of inspiration, they say, ah, that's how it works. Okay, and it's a very simple idea, which for some reason, everyone else had missed. Okay, so people were sort of stumbling along and hoping to fix this and fix that, and you know, the society gets a little bit better and the world gets a little bit better, but there are always these terrible problems. But actually, somebody realized, ah, that's how progress happens. And what they realized is that there's something very fundamental about progress in the world, and it's the relationship between mind and matter. That this is one of the most incredible things about the world, is that out of the universe, out of matter, something arose which was able then to learn the clues about how things work, and then to use those clues to change the world. And so this the fact that the human mind in particular, we don't know if animals do it, but the human mind in particular is capable of conceptualizing the universe using mathematics and utilizing that knowledge is actually the most important driver of progress, and has been for thousands of years. But rather amazingly, it's very underappreciated. So anyway, this person realized the secret, and fortunately, he was in a position to do something about it. And he said, well, you know, the world faces massive, massive problems. We need to find new ways to solve those problems. We need to find new understanding, which will lead to new technologies, which will lead to greater ability on our part to manage the world well. So very fortunately, he was in a position to do something about it. And he said, well, what about creating a place which is just totally focused on this objective, on a better understanding, finding new understanding of the universe, on making the kind of breakthroughs that Einstein made or the founders of quantum mechanics made. And let's try and do it very cleverly and very strategically, but also very humbly. Okay, so we're not going to do it in Harvard or Cambridge or live with all that weight of tradition on our shoulders. You know, we're actually after something extremely simple, which is just, how do we understand the universe better? And so he set about, this was Mike Lazaridis who invented the smartphone, and suddenly became outrageously wealthy. And he thought, you know, I want to do something good with this. I can only wear one pair of shoes at a time, and to drive one car at a time, but maybe I can do something more, a little bit more worthwhile. And so very fortunately, he decided to put this into Perimeter. And not only that, he persuaded the government in Canada, both parts of government, the regional, provincial government, and the federal government, to match what he was contributing. And somehow they bought into this vision, that let's make a really unusual place which is absolutely focused on gaining new understanding of the universe. And that's what happened in Perimeter. So we are in, thanks to those founders of Perimeter, thanks to the supporters of Perimeter, we're in this incredible position now, which no other place in the world is in, where we have been given the opportunity to make the center, which may, we hope, be a treasure for the world, which the discoveries here may change the world. If you look through human history, you know, why did the world progress? Why did human society originate? Why did we learn how to build things, how to make things, how to engineer things? It all traces back to our understanding of the basic rules of the universe. And, you know, I come from Africa originally. The first discoveries of mathematics were in Africa. Nobody even talks about this, but this was seminal, absolutely seminal to the growth of human society. I mean, you all know about the pyramids and probably the first observatories, astronomical observatories, which were in Africa 3,000 years ago. But before that, people were counting. And in the Congo, there's a bone called the Ishango bone, which has all the prime numbers notched on it and estimated to be about 20,000 years old. People don't talk about that, but that's just the beginning. You know, ever since then, we had Pythagoras discovering the laws of geometry and Euclid, and that was the foundation for architecture and design. And of course, it goes on with Galileo discovering the laws of mechanics and Newton translating them into mathematics and calculus. And then, of course, Euler discovering how to use imaginary numbers to connect geometry, analysis, and algebra. And then 200 years later, that mathematical discovery is translated into quantum mechanics by Heisenberg. And this is the story. And, you know, you just look around you and ask whether any of these artifacts would have been possible without physics. And the answer is no. I mean, this is the key. This is the key. So that's the background to Perimeter. That's the opportunity and I say we, because Perimeter is a community. Okay, so you, by walking through that front door, you've become part of this community. So you are a vital element of this project, which is to create a place where we hope discoveries on that order will happen. Discoveries which reveal very basic truths about the universe and which in time will enable human society and the world to progress. That's why we're here, okay? And you're a part of it. So how can you be a part of it? You see, people say, oh, well, you're the director, it's your responsibility, okay? Oh, no, it isn't, okay? It's yours more than mine, actually. Why? Because you wander around, you smile at people, you encourage other people. You know the staff here and knock themselves out, we've already seen that, to accommodate you. Why do you think they're looking after you so well? Why is it when you go to the bistro, they're catering to your every need? It's because they think you might help in this project of discovering great things. Okay, so we have to be humble about this. We're not all going to discover great things, but if we're lucky, we may help create the environment where somebody does. In the end, it may just be one person who finds something spectacular. But if we've all contributed to enable that discovery to be made, you know, we'll have all done something very worthwhile. So that's the spirit and Perimeter in which everyone joins. It's not perfect. Nothing is perfect, but the way it gets better is because people make suggestions and improvements and bring ideas. I'm always challenging everyone in the Institute, you know, come and tell me. If you have an idea, if you think something isn't quite right, we could do something more interesting, more exciting. We don't have to be in class. Okay. If there was a better way for us to speed up the rate of learning and discovery, you know, we wouldn't do classes. We only do classes because we think that might help. You know, you need some skills in order to tackle these very difficult questions. So, but we're here for a reason. And If we figure out a better way of doing things, we'll drop everything and do that. And we can do that. We have unbelievable freedom. This is not a university. Okay? There, to first approximation, there's no bureaucracy here. Okay, so no, it's true. I worked in universities before coming here. I was in Princeton and I was in Cambridge. I know universities extremely well. This is totally different. Okay, zero bureaucracy is our slogan. And we're here for a very clear purpose. And everything here is designed to speed up that purpose. So it should feel like a thrill every day coming to Perimeter, not a grind. Okay, it's a thrill, it's an opportunity. You see, quite frankly, we don't mind what you end up doing. We're not here for you to get a piece of paper. We're here for you to discover what it is you're good at, what it is you love, what is fun, what you might contribute to this crazy enterprise of understanding the universe and thereby advancing progress. So that's why we're here. And I really encourage all of you to grab me if you can. Sometimes I'm moving a little fast. But, tell me something interesting. Tell me an idea you had. Tell me a complaint you have. Not too many of those, please. And, tell me about how you feel about Perimeter, whether it's... whether it really is different, or is it just more of the same? Okay. It shouldn't be more of the same. That's one thing it should never be. So let me talk a little bit. That's the purpose of Perimeter, and I really want all of you to feel you are... Actually, why is there Psi? I'll tell you why there's Psi, because when I arrived at Perimeter, which was 6 years ago, almost 7 years ago, there was no graduate program. Okay, and I walked in, and you have all these really serious researchers slaving over impossible problems. And I thought, oh, this is not going to work. Because young people, especially diverse young people from all over the world, from many different backgrounds, many different cultures, they are an endless source of encouragement, enthusiasm, ideas, energy. You know, the young people have it. That's what you've got. You're lucky. And we needed that. And that's why we made Psi, and that's why you're here, because you might be the key. And I keep telling the staff that we don't know who's going to make the big breakthrough. It might be one of the senior chairs. It might be a Psi student. Okay? Einstein was only, or let's say Dirac was only 23, I think. When he discovered the rules of quantum mechanics and the Dirac equation. You know, I know that's a scary thought. Okay, I don't want to terrify you, but you don't need to do that, okay? But it might very well be somebody young. And that's why we treat everyone at Perimeter the same, because any one of them might potentially have the idea which is crucial. So what about these ideas? What are they going to be? Well, let's look at the state of physics today. Let's look at where we are. And I think I have a different perspective. I have to warn you. My perspective is unusual. I'm in the 1% minority. 99%, I think, take a different point of view than me, let's say, to be polite. My point of view is that, well, physics is easily the most successful basic science. In fact, in some ways, it's the only basic science. I would say whenever mathematics works to describe nature, we call that physics. Okay, so the reason financial mathematics is not in physics is that it doesn't work. Okay. I mean, this is just the reality. Okay, when I was young, I wanted to go into biological mathematics, which is a wonderful field. I mean, what is more interesting than life? But when you try to use math to describe, let's say, an ecosystem, the error bars are, you know, 100%, because there's so many other factors. It's such a complicated system that you can't really predict anything with certainty. Whereas in physics, you know, we can calculate things which in some cases are accurate to one part in a trillion, right? The anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. Or we can predict what we should see in the cosmic microwave background, which is 14 billion light years away. And I did it. Oops. I did calculations which no one had ever done before. We predicted the polarization of the microwave background and how it would correlate with the temperature in 1994. And, you know, straightforward calculation, just turning the crank. Nobody had done it. And then about 10 years later, they did the observations, and it's just spot on, okay, with almost zero error bars. So physics has this crazy, crazy power that the laws we have learnt in various ways, mostly through experimental on Earth and the solar system, do apply throughout the universe and on tiny scales, ridiculous tiny scales. The most amazing example recently was the Higgs boson. You know, the Higgs boson was predicted in a 1.5-page paper in Physical Review Letters, okay, by Peter Higgs, as an afterthought. I mean, he wrote down this idea about what's in the vacuum, that there should be some field in the vacuum to give endow particles with a mass and determine their electric charge. And so I had this great idea, which he actually was inspired by condensed matter physics to about that idea and superconductivity. He tried to do the same in the vacuum of empty space. And so he wrote the paper, beautiful paper, explained how the weak gauge bosons might get a mass. But referee said, no, I want a prediction. You know, there's no prediction here. And he said, oh, yeah, by the way, there's a particle. And so he added one sentence to the paper that, you know, a side effect of that is there is a particle which should be visible. So nobody believed it. It was actually an amazing story. I don't want to tell you the whole story, but I learned it from Peter Higgs. But very unpopular theory at the time, largely ignored, but turned out to be true. 50 years later, 10 billion euro machine, most powerful experiment ever conducted, the Large Hadron Collider, which is just a miracle of modern technology, looked and bingo, there's the Higgs boson, exactly as described by the Higgs mechanism. So, and that's on a scale of a billion times smaller than an atom. So that's the power of physics, is that it somehow reaches way beyond our everyday experience, tells us things about the universe, which it's just a miracle that we can ever learn. So that's how great physics is. But what I want to say is that, and this is where sometimes I disagree with others, is that the last four decades of physics have not been so great. Okay? we've not had discoveries of that kind for a long time. This is not to discourage you, quite the opposite. It's to say that we are entering a period which I believe is similar to the period of the start of the 20th century. Okay, before the beginning, at the end of the 19th century, people had classical mechanics, they had electromagnetism. They thought they'd tied everything up. I mean, they thought they knew all the laws of physics, small details like what's inside the atom, couldn't quite figure out. A little problem with heat that Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism didn't seem completely consistent with the theory of heat because it allowed waves of arbitrarily short wavelength which could carry away infinite amounts of energy. And so a few little problems, but in general they thought, you know, we're finished. We've got Newton, we've got Maxwell, and that's that. But these problems, you know, grew and grew in significance until people realized they were actually a catastrophe. and everything needed to be revised. And so quantum mechanics and relativity came along, and those two fields laid the ground for physics of the 20th century. So to a large extent, the 20th century was all about working out the consequences of relativity and quantum mechanics. Now, the situation we're in is totally different. Why? Because there are very, very serious clouds on the horizon. We have incredible new data, which is ruling out theories in their droves, okay, which is a wonderful situation to be in. And the most amazing thing to me is that the data is pointing to simplicity, incredible simplicity. And I'll explain why I believe that the structure of the universe on large scales is simpler than the structure of an atom. That's what we've discovered. The whole universe is simpler than one atom. It's insane, but that is what the data is telling us. And we have no idea, theoretically, why that is. So at the same time, the theoretical situation is kind of catastrophic. String theory, supersymmetry, grand unified theories make all kinds of assumptions, inflationary theory, make all kinds of assumptions, all kinds of arbitrary parameters enter the theory. We have a catastrophe of predictability. We can't predict anything. I mean, string theory, it's a wonderful theory, hasn't predicted anything successfully. Okay. Lots of wrong things. Okay. But it's not a theory because it's not specific yet. It doesn't say, if you measure this X, you will get Y. There's not one such prediction. So I don't want to be negative. These are all great ideas. They're all very interesting. I would say the last 40 years, there's been lots of interesting explanations, but it's kind of great, but no cigar. Okay, I don't know if you know that phrase. It's a very poor phrase because I don't think anyone celebrates with a cigar today. You don't celebrate by giving yourself lung cancer. But but anyway, that's the. I think these are exciting ideas, but we should have no illusions. They do not live up to the successes of the past. Yes, we should keep exploring. But, when you explore, there are basically two ways to do it. You can say, okay, I'll follow this narrow channel, right? You might choose to do that because it's popular. Okay, that's probably the worst reason to pursue anything, because it's popular. Because the fact it's popular means it's past its sell-by date. Okay. When things get popular, it's usually they're in the beginning of decline. I mean, the time to invest, anyone who does investing knows that you invest when things are growing and when other people haven't yet seen it. Anyway, so the popular idea is, draw thousands of people to work on the same kind of thing, on some small variation. It's great to do such things because you gain exercise and confidence and you learn techniques. And so I encourage all of you to jump into projects where you will actually calculate something. That's great. But don't have any illusions. This is not really where the progress is going to come from. Progress is going to require simple, bold ideas, which almost certainly will look crazy when they first arise. Okay, but if you think how quantum mechanics arose, Planck struggled with this contradiction between heat and electromagnetism. And he concluded that as crazy as it is, a photon can only carry energy in quanta determined by its frequency. And so he said, that's the only way I can make sense of that. And the reason it works is that if the frequency, you see this catastrophe of thermodynamics was that the very short waves, if you have short waves, you can pack them into a given volume, like this room, you can fit short waves in infinite number of ways. almost infinite number of ways. So the shorter the wave, the more ways there are to put a wave in a given box. So the problem was with the short waves, that if I have a hot body, it can emit arbitrary numbers of short waves. Now, by making this quantization rule, he said, oh no, the short waves have very high frequency, and they can only be emitted in packets of energy which are very large. Okay, and by doing that, he suppressed the emission of those short waves. So it was a very clever and very subtle and totally radical and ridiculous sounding notion, but it opened the door to quantum mechanics. And likewise, Niels Bohr. I'm very fortunate, I hold the Niels Bohr chair here, so I have to do something at least as good as Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr said, you know, trying to understand why an electron didn't fall into the atomic nucleus. And so he said, well, he got the clue from Planck that something is quantized, and he said, well, the angular momentum of the electron must be quantized. So the electron, when it orbits, can only take angular momentum in certain units, and this is what prevents the electron falling into the atom. So a completely crazy idea, completely incompatible with classical mechanics, but that was a clue. And of course, he was inspired by observations. And this clue, over 10 years later, gave rise to Heisenberg's quantum mechanics. So this is the kind of idea actually physics needs now, in my opinion. We've got these very profound clues. What are the clues? Well, one of the most profound is that the whole universe came out of nothing, came out of a singularity. Okay, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, everything we see came out of a point, a Big Bang singularity. And of course, that's the place where all the laws of physics fail. And but it's a huge clue. And we know a lot about the singularity now, because we can map the radiation which came out of the singularity. We map its structure. We know its form. As I said, it's extraordinarily simple. You need two numbers to describe the pattern of variation in density in the universe on large scales. Just two numbers. It's Gaussian random noise with a nearly scale invariant spectrum. So there's an amplitude of the fluctuations and a small variation with scale. And that's it. You have two numbers. Now you ask, how many numbers do our theories have, which people try to use to fit the data? And the theories always have many more than two numbers. And the theories predict all kinds of other things, like gravitational waves, which were acclaimed last year and then went away, and which I hope to win a bet with Stephen Hawking very soon. So theory is not in great shape. We need better theories. So this is both kind of scary for a theorist, because you say, we have these incredible theories from the past which really work. We have the Standard Model. So same thing with the Large Hadron Collider. It found the Higgs boson. And then most particle theorists were confidently predicting there's going to be supersymmetry. And so far, it ain't there. Okay, and this is a very, very fundamental problem, because for some reason the Higgs particle has a mass which is 10 to the power 17 smaller than the Planck mass. Okay, and understanding why that mass is so small is a huge problem called fine-tuning problem. And so all these other particles, these supersymmetric particles, were introduced in order to keep that mass low. It's a very contrived and artificial theory. I mean, it's really, I've always hated it, okay? Because you had to double all the particles, and you had to fit, you know, you introduced 120 free parameters. And, you know, any sensible scientist would throw up their hands in horror. But the majority of people, the 99%, for some reason, don't have any, you know, the trouble is you make a theory with 120 parameters, and you'll get 120 papers per week. Because people, yeah, great, I can play with this, and I can do this and that, and you know, this scenario and that scenario. And So we have an extravaganza of models and theories. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's fun. And, you know, that's one way to try to make progress. But I think we should all, and often, you know, we need to write papers. And so, indeed, people should do this and play with these models and so on. But let's not have an illusion that that this is really going to be the way the big discoveries happen. So the first big clue is a singularity. Second big clue is actually that the Higgs boson is light, and so far there's nothing around to protect that lightness. That's a fine-tuning problem, okay? But there's a much bigger fine-tuning problem, which is the vacuum energy. So this was discovered in cosmology, and again, I was very fortunate to actually predict one of the ways of confirming the presence of dark energy, which has recently been confirmed at very, very high confidence. So we're pretty sure now that space, empty space, has energy, the dark energy. We have no clue what it is. And we've really not got no clue what its significance is. And it's a huge fine-tuning problem, because the size of this dark energy is about 120 orders of magnitude smaller than you would naively predict using quantum field theory. Okay, so in quantum field theory, we generally just throw away the vacuum energy for no good reason. But the trouble is, every time you do a calculation or some new effect, it contributes to the vacuum energy. So the vacuum energy is composed of lots and lots of contributions, and in the end, we have to say, for some reason, it's really tiny, but not zero. And so this has led some people to a sort of counsel of despair, which is the anthropic principle, to say, well, it is what it is, because if it was any different, we wouldn't be here. And that's not a very predictive idea. It's more just a way of living with things. I'm not that impressed. We have this clue, which is a dark energy. And what do you do about it? Now, you know, that's the challenge. Now, one of the great strange things about this dark energy is it causes the universe to accelerate in its expansion. So instead of the expansion slowing down and ultimately sort of the universe just going quiescent or static, nearly static, instead of that happening, the acceleration, the universe expansion starts to accelerate exponentially, driven by the dark energy. And this means that galaxies or stars beyond a certain distance from us will actually never be visible to us, because they're sitting at some distance. I mean, there was the Big Bang 14 billion years ago. We can only see 14 billion light years today. If we ask what's beyond that, we could only see it if we waited longer in time. But unfortunately, because the universe is starting to expand, accelerate, that stuff is going to be moving too fast away from us. So light will never catch up with it. And we will never see beyond a certain finite volume of our universe, if this dark energy lasts forever. So then we're in this puzzling situation where the best theory we have of the universe, Einstein's theory of gravity, which is spectacularly successful, has within it a notion of a universe, of an perhaps infinite universe beyond what which we can see, which we somehow have to specify, but we can never observe. Okay, and in essence, this is the multiverse, which you may have heard of. Okay, and again, some people welcome the multiverse. They say, well, we live in one part of the universe, could be other parts of the universe. They're maybe disconnected from us. Maybe they're just too far away to see. Maybe they're just completely disconnected from our universe. And amazingly enough, theorists start to speculate about the multiverse. Why do I say amazingly? Because to me, it's completely manifest that these speculations are never going to lead anywhere. I mean, you can speculate about all kinds of things which you will never probe and which will never influence you. And I'm not sure what the value is in such speculation. But amazingly, a lot of it happens, and you'll find a lot of speculation on the archive about the multiverse. To me, this is a catastrophe quite parallel to Planck's catastrophe. You know, Planck discovered that the known laws of physics led to something insane. And something which you couldn't predict. And that's the same with the multiverse. It's a sort of catastrophe of huge amount of redundant information and things in your theory which neither influence you nor you can ever influence. And so I personally think this is a very profound clue that somehow, and given that the universe is so simple on large scales, I think when we see things the right way, we will understand that all this stuff beyond the universe we can actually see won't be, you know, just an extrapolation of today's universe with all kinds of additional information and initial conditions and so on. So these are ideas I wish more people were struggling with. The very small scale catastrophes like the fine-tuning of the Higgs boson, the very large scale catastrophes like the dark energy and what it means. And then of course there's the quantum, the nature of quantum mechanics and what that means. And the reason that's so exciting today is that we are getting the technological capacity to really manipulate the quantum world. We had a wonderful conference here in June called Convergence, and the talks are online, and I encourage you to look at those talks. They were intended to be half-hour talks. Usually the people were so excited they couldn't stop themselves going longer, but these were sort of introductory talks to a number of very frontier areas of physics. And just as one example, Emmanuel Bloch from the Max Planck Institute talked about experimental quantum systems like atomic lattices. So you have laser beams forming a crisscross pattern and they trap atoms. And this is extremely clean system in which you can study quantum phases and the quantum behavior of matter. Just as one example, using these lattices, they can build clocks of almost unimaginable accuracy, so that he predicts in his talk that within, I think, 2 years, we will have a clock which is accurate to a part in 10 to the 17. So over the whole lifetime of the universe, this clock would lose 1 second. Okay, so that's what's coming in 2 years. Okay, so, you know, can we use that clock to test fundamental physics in a new way? Undoubtedly. I mean, there will be clever ideas how to use these technologies to learn about fundamental physics. And so that's an incredible frontier, the quantum frontier. Of course, we hope we'll see a quantum computer in the next who knows when. But things are going very, very fast on that front. And there's, of course, very exciting work happening at the Institute for Quantum Computing, experimental work, and computational algorithm work to try to figure out how you actually design a quantum computer. But I think all of us in Perimeter, pretty much all of us, worry about quantum. Whether we're doing particle physics, cosmology, quantum information, quantum foundations, quantum gravity, quantum field theory, you know, quantum is it. Okay, and yet we are still sort of struggling with what quantum really means, because quantum theory is pretty crazy. We're describing the world with complex numbers. You know, I is in Schrodinger's equation. What does that mean? It's the square root of minus one. It's pretty hard to visualize, but that's where quantum mechanics is. And something I'm very excited about in my current work is both understanding quantum tunneling from a much more fundamental point of view. You know, when something goes through a barrier, classically this is just impossible. You're stuck in a potential well, and you have only a certain amount of energy, and there's just no way you can get out. But quantum mechanically, it leaks through, and you know, how did it leak through? Where was the particle when it leaks through? And so I have a new way of describing that, which gives some kind of answer to that question. And actually, quantum tunneling is one of these phenomena that are everywhere. So it's there in, of course, nuclear physics. It's there in theories of cosmology. Inflationary theories are all about being stuck in the wrong vacuum and then using this exponential expansion to blow up the universe and then quantum tunneling out of that vacuum to another, to a lower energy vacuum. So again, sort of, it's an example where almost everyone at the Institute has some interest. And that's one of the great things about theoretical physics, is that all, in principle, everyone in this Institute can understand everyone else. In principle, I say. In practice, it's not so easy. Okay. But we all talk the same language, which is just mathematics. We all agree what the right laws of physics are, the known ones, even though they have problems. They fail to explain certain things. And so we have a lot of common ground. And so I think pretty much, you know, one thing I'd encourage you to do as a student here is talk to lots of people, okay? Socialize, hang out near the coffee machine, you know, grab somebody and say, what do you do, and why is it interesting? You learn a lot just through chatting to people. So I think I want to shut up and take any questions. Let me just end by encouraging you to make the most of your time here. One of wonderful things about PSI is essentially no obligation on any of you, right? You've all done well anyway. You've all got a great degree you've got here. You have this year to enjoy, right? Just think about what you want to do and try to find what you really care about. If you're going to go into physics, it's an insane field. We are all about tackling impossible problems. Okay. The only interesting problems are nearly impossible. We hope they're nearly impossible. We don't know that. They may be impossible. Okay. So if you decide to devote yourself to this, you know, it's not a decision you should take easily. And many of the PSI graduates have decided, no, it's not for me. I'll go and do something more predictable than trying to be the next Einstein. Those of us who stay, you know, just feel it's an incredible privilege to be able to work on these questions, and even think about them. And yes, indeed, the answers may be a long way off, but it's still a privilege just to be able to discuss them. So that kind of keeps us going. Even though, as I said, I think if you take a cold, hard look at the real progress in theory, it's been less than claimed on the box, let's say. But that doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that it's all to play for. And actually, what's new today is we have this data. You know, for 40 years, theorists have been working on string theory and grand unified theory and all these other things, with very little data. Now we have the data. And over the next year, if LHC finds nothing, essentially all the theories will be in major crisis. And that's a huge opportunity for everyone, and especially people like you, to come up with some really radical, simple new idea. And, you know, that's what we'd love you to do. Don't ask much, do we? Okay, so are there any questions? We still have a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. I'm not going to go away until you ask questions.
Yeah. You based the idea of UFOBI in stuff that you had done in Africa before, or institutes that existed there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm from Africa, and I got a chance to help make centers in Africa. And in fact, this is the reason I didn't come yesterday morning, is that we had some very urgent matters we have to deal with. We have 5 institutes in Africa, and you know, management is a nightmare. And I encourage you never to start anything, and never to run anything, because even though it's great fun, it's also, you know, I think anyone who starts anything realizes how tough it is. But no, that is actually why Perimeter hired me, I believe. I was in Cambridge, and I was director of the Cosmology Center there, and I worked with Stephen Hawking and so on. I was quite happy there. I wasn't looking to move. But because I'm from South Africa, I had been drawn into this project of making maths institutes. And that was a situation where basically there were almost no opportunities for young Africans to go on to do the kinds of things you're doing. And that seemed really unfair to me, and also just a huge waste of talent. So we started this project. It was kind of a crazy thing to do because we didn't have any money, and most people thought we were nuts. You know, you want to teach Africans mathematics? You know, why? Why don't you give them food and medicine and, you know, clean water? But we did it anyway, and it turned out to be very, very successful. So right now we have 250 students at 5 AIM centers across Africa, and we've got 1,000 alumni. So I was very lucky to, you know, I was not interested in management at all. I mean, I'm a straight researcher. But through this sense of obligation and commitment and history, I was drawn in to help create these institutes in Africa. And I guess, you know, Perimeter, like I mentioned, Mike Lazaridis, who founded Perimeter, and Howard Burton, the first director, had a similar sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And everyone laughed at them. I laughed at them, you know. At first I heard about Perimeter is there's some crazy guy who's given Lee Smolin $100 million to solve quantum gravity. I was in Cambridge at the time. He said, oh yeah, good luck. and they actually came to Cambridge, and they wandered around, and they looked at our building in Cambridge, and they stole all the good ideas and helped to design Perimeter. So, yeah, they were very entrepreneurial, and I hope at some point in this year you'll get to meet Mike. He's a very, very unusual person, absolutely altruistic. You know, he made this huge amount of money, but he really not interested in money. He always says there's no value in money. He always talks about value. And when he talks about value, what he means is understanding. I mean, the real value is in understanding. And so, yeah, Mike founded this, and they were looking for someone to take over. And so they asked me to come, and I basically said, well, I'll come as long as Perimeter will support what I'm doing in Africa. And he was delighted to do that. And that's why at the moment Perimeter, actually, you know, we're doing things in Africa, we're doing things in Latin America, we're doing things in India. We have a program we call Global Outreach. And the goal of Global Outreach is to make sure that, you know, among the 7 billion mostly young people on the planet, there is access to good training and good opportunities to do basic research. That's the goal in a nutshell. And it's very, very exciting. I mean, it's just such an obvious truth that the future of the world is its young people. It's just totally obvious. And if the world had any sense, it would give the young people great opportunities instead of just stressing them out all the time with more. I know, because I've got a daughter. She tells me about it. Who is, you know, instead of just worrying people and overloading them and talking about all the horrible mess which my generation has created. If people were a little bit more focused on giving opportunities to young people, I think that would be much more productive. I'm sure you agree. So when we created Psi, my experience was in Africa. Psi is just a copy of what we found out and developed in Africa. So like everything good in the world, it all originates in Africa. There was going to be an African student here, but unfortunately he has a family problem and couldn't join you. But there are quite a few African students around. And in fact, many Psi graduates have gone on to teach in the centers in Africa. We do have, just like the tutors here, once you graduate from Psi, you could be a similar tutor in a center in Africa. So a lot of people have really enjoyed that. Some have made movies about it and a lot of fun experiences. So there's quite a lot of networking goes on between AIMS, which is the African Institute for Mathematical Science, and Perimeter, and with other centers. We have a new connection with Latin America, the South American Institute of Fundamental Research. So are any of you from South America? You are. Oh, good. So you know about it. So Pedro Vieira is going to be leading the effort to sort of reach out to Latin America and help create opportunities for young Latin Americans to come into theoretical physics. So yeah, we're in a very unique place. We're very entrepreneurial. We're very outgoing. We try to be very humble. And that fits really well with Canada. Canada is probably the humblest country in the world. We have incredible support from government. They love us, I'm happy to say. And while you're here, you'll see some evidence of that. Quite a lot of the local dignitaries and politicians and people come to visit, and they're all very proud of Perimeter. And they're always, you know, the best thing for them is actually meeting you. Because then you're much more exciting than meeting Lee Smolin. So, are there any other questions? I'm sure you've got a question. No? Okay. I'm going to just wait. Otherwise, I'll start asking you questions. Where are you from?
The States.
Are you from the States? How many are from the U.S. here?
Just two.
Okay. Whereabouts?
Originally Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, right. Great. So why did you just decide to come to Canada for graduate?
I'd see the PSI courses on Pearsa.
Oh, good.
And I thought it would be interesting.
Great. One of the things we're contemplating is try to make those courses, you know, make it possible for people to actually take those courses online. So we're sort of discussing how to do it, like a MOOC. Yeah, like EdX or like a MOOC, to have a little bit of tutoring support as well. And how do we do that? So we're sort of brainstorming what the best way is to do that. Sure. Yes, I think so. I think everybody said it was very successful. Some people want it to happen next year. I don't think it's going to happen next year because it was a big, huge effort to organize the whole thing. Probably 2 years. Okay, but we did invite all the Psi alumni, so the next one you will all be invited to. We had a great combination of Psi alumni. There were about 100 Psi alumni there. And then we had 25 of our distinguished visiting research chairs who all came not even to talk. So we just 25 of the most senior distinguished theoretical physicists in the world, and they just came to hang out, okay? And so it was pretty great. I mean, If you're wandering around in the atrium, you would bump into Peter Shor, who developed the quantum factoring algorithm. Jim Bardeen was hanging out. And that's exactly the environment we want, right? So we want a place where it's not just self-promotion. You know, conferences are terribly boring often. You go there and you just hear people telling you, I've done this great thing, you know. And you know the reality is the progress is really slow, okay? And mostly people are just repeating what they said at the previous conference. So the whole point of Convergence was to try to break that down. I have very few talks, which each one is just undoubtedly, you know, really inspiring. I mean, one of them is, we're about to see the black hole in the Milky Way, right? We're about to actually make an image. Again, in the next 2 years, we should have a picture of the black hole. Is that mind-blowing? Of course, it's unbelievable. Okay. And what? Watch Avery Broderick's talk. It's called the Event Horizon Telescope. So basically use all the radio telescopes on Earth to make a giant radio telescope. And you know the angular resolution is inversely proportional to the size. So it's a huge telescope, and it just turns out that the angular resolution you get by using the whole Earth as a radio telescope is just what you need to make a picture of the black hole.
What's the name of the telescope?
Event Horizon Telescope, EHT. So,
what's the
sorry?
The kind of Falcon?
Say that again.
Kind of
Falcon? Avery Broderick is our researcher who works on this. So actually, he gave the talk. He's very young, and he's one of the leaders in that telescope.
Would you mind if we wanted to come have a chat with you? Should we just drop an email, or
are you
busy?
No, I am very busy, but just grab me anywhere, anytime. given that I do tend to move a little fast, but I'm always willing to be grabbed. And discuss at a high board rate. I don't know if you even know what a board rate is. Do you know what a board rate is? Okay, so I'm showing my age. When we first had laptops, and this would have been in the 90s, so you had a laptop and you had to dial into the mainframe in the department from home. So you plugged in your telephone cable, and you type something in, and it made a funny noise. And your laptop was talking to the mainframe, you know, communicating, and it logged you in. And the speed of that transfer of data down the phone line is called the baud rate. So high baud rate is if you're, you know, really talking fast. So anyway, I'm sure there's some modern word which I should know but don't know. No, the main message is have fun here. Don't stress over anything. Every day is an opportunity. You're probably all good at getting A++ in every course. You don't have to. Doesn't matter. In fact, the last several years, the Psi students have not last year. I think the previous years they voted they didn't want any distinguishing between the students. It's an option. We listen to you, but grades, you're not here for grades. You know, you're here to learn and decide what you want to do. We're just here to facilitate that. Yeah.
Just tell us something recently.
Well, there are many, many interesting things, and many interesting things going on in this building. Okay, so I'll tell you one of the most interesting things happening in this building. Maybe a couple. Okay, so a little bit random, my choice. But have you heard of Bell's theorem? Bell inequality, the Bell inequality. So there was a young Irish physicist called John Bell in the 1960s, who was, you know, everyone had learned the laws of quantum mechanics, but he was the first to really try to make precise why quantum mechanics is so bizarre, in some respect. So he considered this experiment where two particles are emitted in a singlet, quantum singlet state. One would spin up, one would spin down, and then they travel apart. And then the kind of naive way of looking at it, you know, if I measure this one is up, I know this one is down. Okay, so it, very naive point of view, you say you have faster than light communication. Okay. Of course, you could do the same with two envelopes. You could send that two envelopes, one with up and one with down, and you open this envelope, you know the other one is down. So it's much more than that. What he actually proved is that when you consider the probability of various outcomes or various measurements of these particles, you can demonstrate, you can prove an inequality that for any classical picture where the particle has a definite spin and position, and you measure it, for any classical picture at all, any possible classical model, there's this inequality. You cannot get the probabilities to violate a certain inequality. And then he showed quantum mechanics violates the inequality. Okay, so what it tells you is that the world cannot be modeled as a classical machine. It's just impossible. So he, by if you do this experiment and you confirm quantum mechanics, you have disproved all possible classical pictures of the world. That's what he showed. And then in the 70s, the experiment was done, and they confirmed quantum mechanics. So we know the world is not what we think it is. Okay, we know the world is not classical. That's how we picture the world, but it's wrong. And actually, I think this is probably part of the story about the multiverse, that we're trying to picture the universe as classical, but it's probably not. We know it's not. So that was the Bell inequality. So very recently, last 3 months, one of the researchers here, Rob Speckens, published a paper with a new version of Bell inequality. The Bell inequality was based on local causality. So one of the assumptions in this classical model, the allowed classical models, is that whatever you do over here cannot influence that because the distance is greater than the speed of light times the time. So one of the assumptions about these classical models is that they would have to be causal. Okay, so what he was able to, so that's causality. It's a picture of causality which involves relativity, involves the speed of light. But he was able to prove a version of Bell's theorem which does not rely on local causality. It rests on a more primitive idea of causation. Okay, so causation is a much more basic idea. You know, A causes B. It doesn't really talk about the speed of light or relativity or anything. And so he found a version of Bell's theorem which disproves any model which is causative in the classical sense. Okay, that you have probabilities, but you still have some notion that A causes B. And then there are various other assumptions which are classical assumptions of actually, the ideas come from machine learning and some other fields, even statistics and inference. But he proved a revised version. He and others here proved a revised version of Bell's inequality. And then the experiment was done at IQC. And I think with 1,000 sigma accuracy, they disproved all possible causative classical models of that, the physics. So that was pretty exciting because this is really 50 years later than Bell. It's somehow a more fundamental notion that's being tested. And again, it's a measure of quantum mechanics strangeness. It's not just doing it to find that it's strange. You're understanding better what is the difference between quantum and classical, and then you hope that by understanding that difference, you may be able to exploit it. So there may be technologies. The fact you can now do the experiment to demonstrate this difference implies that maybe you can actually build technologies that rest, you know, that benefit from that difference, that quantum difference. So that's a kind of very interesting frontier. Another thing which is very exciting here in recent work has been a connection between gravity, theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of gravity, and quantum many-body systems. So quantum systems which involve large numbers of particles or spins or objects have bizarre collective behavior. They have phases like superconductivity or the quantum Hall effect. They have these wonderful phases which are really totally quantum in nature and rely on entanglement of particles. But what was understood in the 90s by Meldacena initially was this idea of holography, that a gravitational system can represent this quantum many-body system or a quantum field theory. Initially only in very special models, which are of not much interest in themselves, supersymmetric models, but this has been generalized, and so now there are more ideas. So people here have been very active in exploring the connection between gravity, gravitational description, and the quantum phase description. And so, yeah, there's a lot of activity on that. In general, understanding the quantum behavior of complicated systems is very exciting field. And there's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years in particular. Something I think is very important, you see, when you look at the fine-tuning problem of the Higgs boson, why is it so light? How does that work? All those fine-tuning arguments are perturbative. All the ways people calculate the vacuum energy, when I said they get 120 orders of magnitude wrong, they're all perturbative. It means you start with a free theory and then you do calculations in coupling perturbatively. These are very profound clues that nature doesn't use perturbation theory, okay? and I think that's the kind of thing you learn by studying these quantum many-body systems. You discover phases which you would never have guessed using perturbation theory. It's not really, you know, charged particles interacting weakly. No, not at all. There are collective effects. Cannot be understood perturbatively. So I think this is a very hard field, but it's absolutely a frontier. And we're probably not going to make progress until we understand how to go beyond perturbation theory. I mean, you're going to take courses in quantum field theory, and all you'll learn will be perturbation theory because that's all we can do, basically. But we all know that something else is going on. Yep.
I know the students would prefer to keep chatting with you, but we have a lecture scheduled for 10:30. Is it possible?
Oh, okay, right. I will depart. So I hope to see you around. And good luck with everything. Please enjoy and please grab me from time to time. I look forward to hearing from you. And then we meet September the 9th. Yeah, September the 9th for 3 weeks. Relativity. That's right. Good. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.